Hey, so thanks for joining in. I'm Andrew Mall, or you can follow me on Twitter at AskTheData, and I'm here today to talk a little bit about Spark with some of the people who are actually making it work on Azure. So this is Alejandro and Joel, and they're both on the HG Insight team and working specifically on Spark. They're going to tell us some really cool stuff on how exactly Spark works, focusing on just Apache Spark and looking at the internals, and then moving into how it actually works on HG Insight. So, really excited about that. We're filming it here in Building 17 in Redmond. And I walked into the conference room where we're filming, and there's this giant horse, I guess. Yeah, moose. He's a moose. And I want to know the story. So, is there any story behind this moose? I see he's missing an ear, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, that just happened. No, we wanted to have this room to be like a lodge, and hence people can't see, but we have like a fake fireplace decal, and we have the moose head, and it just felt like something that would be like a cabin type of experience.
So I should have started this out as like, "Welcome to our cabin." Out in the Vermont countryside where all the snow is happening right now. No. Awesome. Cool. Yeah, this is a cool room here. Oh, the building just got redone. But I'm gonna turn it back over to Alejandro, who's gonna go ahead and kind of start talking a little about the Spark internals.
Sure. So, I guess I'm going to go to the board.
Sure. Yeah, if
And
you'd like to use that.
so we should talk about what Spark is. Spark is an Apache project that builds on top of the MapReduce projects that were in Apache before. The real novel concept from Spark is the concept of the RDD, which is a resilient distributed data set. And we can contrast that to what MapReduce was in the sense that the RDD, it gets distributed across the worker nodes, and there is a set of APIs, of Spark APIs, that you can do on top of the RDD to transform it. And so the way the RDD works is, think of it as loading a file into memory, applying a bunch of transformations on top of it. Those are lazily evaluated, and until you do an action on top of it, then you get your worker nodes to transform the RDD and output the result somehow, either to another RDD in memory or say write to a file, things like that. To give you an idea of what the transforms are for the IDD, you can do things like do a map on all of the rows in the IDD, or do a reduce by key once you have the key value pair. You can filter rows, certain rows, things like that. And yeah, so the RDDs are the big thing in Spark. They make things very easily parallelizable. And they live on the cluster, especially they live on the Spark driver, which is in a head node in the cluster. I don't know if you want to contrast it with MR.
Yeah, so it's kind of similar to MR, right? So you can almost think of the RDD gets pushed into where on top of the HDFS, right? So you'd have the HDFS file store, that RDD would be kind of reading on top of that, caching it into memory, and allowing it to be used much faster.
Yeah, that's a cool thing about the RDDs. Spark is an in-memory technology, and so what it tries to do is load the entire data set into memory. If it fails to do that, then it'll go to disk. But if it's in memory, if the entire data set fits in memory, then it's real quick.
Yeah, and that's why you'll see when you go to provision a Spark cluster, you'll see the D series are kind of your default because Spark is so memory intensive. And that's also kind of why you see the 10 to 100 times faster queries, and it actually becomes interactive, where a MapReduce cluster isn't as interactive. You kind of set and forget, get a coffee, come back and see those results. Not to say that one is better than the other. They're pretty typical. They have different use cases,
It's
right?
batch versus
Batch
interactive.
versus interactive. You're always going to have batch processing. There's always going to be way too much data to handle in an interactive fashion. So that's where that really shines. And then this is for more of that interactive querying experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a concept of a Spark Master. The Spark Master has a bunch of apps, and then those apps are mapped to a Spark driver. Before we go there, every app is managed by the Spark Master in a certain way. So the Spark Master can do it via standalone, Yarn or Mesos, which means that the resources that are in the cluster are managed either by Spark itself in the standalone case,
mm-hmm.
or by Yarn or by Mesos. Right now in AG Insight, it's a standalone. And that means that the Spark Master has knowledge of what resources the workers have, things like memory or cores. Once an app is created on the Spark Master, resources are allocated to that app, and then that app creates an execution called Spark Driver, and that Spark Driver basically creates a Spark context. When you create a Spark context, you can start creating RDDs. The metadata for the RDDs are on the Spark Driver, things like how to get from, say, a text file to do all the transformations and get to the final result for the RDD, the schema, and everything. But the data actually lives on the worker nodes, and the worker nodes do all the operations on top of that.
Okay, and so those RDDs are stored on disk or in memory, or?
So those RDDs can be stored on any data ingestion platform that Spark supports.
Mm-hmm.
So things like HDFS or WASB, which is on top of Azure Storage, and you load the file from there, and then it goes to memory.
Okay.
If it doesn't fit in memory, Spark has the ability to go to disk, but it tries to be in memory so that it's really fast.
And that's how you get some of the benefits that everyone talks about with Spark, and how
exactly.
It's 100 times faster than
exactly.
than some of the other more batch processing of Hadoop, to interactive, so to say.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So those are the RDDs. As I said, they live on the worker nodes, the data lives on the worker nodes, but they're all managed by the Spark context, which is in the driver. Again, one app maps to a driver. You can have multiple apps, and so you'll get multiple drivers. And the RDDs are then transformed, and you can do actions on top of them. And the actions will say things like filter, or things like, map, reduce by key, so you can work on your data set. So that's basically how it works. Once you do actions on top of your RDD, and you want to, say, collect them, or write to disk, things like that, what gets launched is a job to the workers. And in those jobs could go to different workers because the RDDs are distributed. And that job is then partitioned into tasks. And when those are executed and they're finished, the result goes back to the user.
Now, it's also good to call out that an app has a driver, and if there are multiple apps, they'll have individual drivers, and they don't share the context or the RDDs because they're isolated across.
Yeah.
And so that's something to take into consideration where you're developing, is if you want to have these things shared, they should all be in an app, one
yeah.
single app.
Yeah, they should share the Spark context.
Okay.
There's also, you could also say create a table against the Hive Metastore, and that way you could share the different tables or data frames across the apps. But that's, you would have to take care of that.
Okay, so each app is created when I submit a job, so to say?
Each app is created. It depends on how you do it, and I guess you all can talk about it.
Okay, we'll get there.
When the apps get created.
Okay.
So yeah, those are the Spark internals.
Okay, so then do you want to talk a little bit about how those pieces fit together and kind of what each one of those does in regards to how a job is submitted?
Yeah, let's just start over with the contents on the browser when a customer is outside the cluster itself. So they usually, their entry point or the desired entry point that we want is for them to open up their browser, type in their cluster DNS name, authenticate, and that will get them through this gateway. From there, their interactions are something that we already know, like the two notebooks. Note that my green line goes to those two notebooks, and not the Spark Submit. If you were wanted to use Spark Submit or any Spark shell, you'd have to RDP to the cluster to the head node and then be able to start one of these sessions over, and they'll get you. So when the customer starts a notebook session, each Zeppelin will create a Spark context for you automatically, and that will register an application, which will then create a Spark driver. In the case of Jupyter, Jupyter is just a blank canvas, and so you are in charge of typing each of these commands. So you will have to manually say, I want a new Spark context. Here is the Spark master URL that I want you to hit. And when you do that, when that code is executed, it will then register itself as an application with the Spark master, and that will create a Spark driver, and all of this will be set up. We talked in another video on how do you configure the Zeppelin interpreter, where you can talk about cores and you can talk about memory. The same type of configurations you would have to do in Jupyter by creating a Spark configuration object, and you can start to pass in both the Spark master URL, maximum cores, the maximum memory, whether to use or reuse a Hive context or not, and all of these options are available there. It's just you have to kind of know the syntax and execute those separately. And so that's how it would flow, where a user would start off from a browser, load up a notebook of preference, have it create a context, and then they'll be able to either file in Scala code or Python code or just SQL code, and it will be sent to the Spark master, which will then distribute it out to the worker nodes and get the results back.
Okay, so is that similar to how you would have a typical MR cluster? You would have Yarn associating each of those tasks and kind of managing the whole distribution, or what is it in Spark? Is it all built on Yarn as well? Is there a similar?
There are options. Mm-hmm. So by default, Spark,
always options.
Yeah, there's always options. Spark by default can handle the resource allocation, but you can also configure it. For example, through Jupyter or through the Spark config to use Yarn as the resource allocation. Or there's another one called Mesos, right?
Okay.
Which you could also do. It just depends on what you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it.
And so so there's always the ability to configure it, to configure Spark itself to go against different resource managers. Right now it's in standalone.
Okay.
The work to get it to Yarn or something like that, we're working on that and we'll enable that in the future. But right now it's a standalone, which means that the master itself knows about the resources throughout the cluster in the worker nodes, and then allocates them to the different apps as they're created.
Okay, so the master takes care of that distribution right now.
Yep.
Okay. And so a little more on like kind of the worker nodes and the head node and the gateway. So when I spin up a Spark cluster right now in HD Insight and I say I want two worker nodes, that's kind of the only, and a head node. Is that all I'm getting within that ecosystem, or am I getting anything else?
There's a few
three
things.
VMs?
There's a few things that go into a cluster that not necessarily are placed here just because we wanted to simplify it. You obviously have your worker nodes. You obviously have your head nodes. There's a zookeeper node that does some of the resource allocation and kind of the mapping of what lives in the cluster. Also, there are some redundant nodes, especially for the head node and the gateway and the zookeeper nodes, such that if there's a failover, there's a way to preserve the functionality. Now, the unfortunate part is, as we mentioned before, the Spark master and the drivers, they live on the instance of this head node particularly. So if you're in the middle of an application and there's a failover and the other head node starts, it doesn't know any of these things. So you'd have to restart and resubmit your application for it to continue.
Okay.
It's an unfortunate part, but it's really hard for them to do the job level or even application level failover, where it all just naturally seamless works.
And that's Spark across the board,
Spark, yes.
Right? That's just a Spark quirk, so to say.
At this point. It's not it's something that
any Spark cluster that you run is going to have those.
If the master were to ever die, then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless it were to run on Yarn, which then Yarn would take care of it.
Okay.
But as it is, a Spark standalone, if the master goes down, then the application will most likely fail.
So what else is in there? So your Spark submit box on the corner there, is that going to be just the command line where you go in, you can just use your Spark console?
Yes, it's literally starting it up. Because it's in the cluster itself is already pre-configured to work. You just double-click on it, and you get just a nice prompt for you to go at and start typing your Scala code and executing it directly to the Spark Master. The unfortunate part is, well, it's a command line, right? If you print stuff, it'll not be as readable as you would want, unless you're doing just transformations to save it to a file that you're then going to visualize somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the challenge is you're remoting into this machine.
Sure.
You have to then extract it somehow, the file, or put it into your storage account. So it's not the typical or the best experience we would want customers to have. And that's why we believe the notebooks are a big investment to really be the face of Spark and create a really good, rich experience.
Yeah, and don't worry if you don't have a lot of experience with Zeppelin or Jupyter. We dive deeper in those in some secret sessions that are going to be released in the coming weeks.
And then you could also see here. You could also say use ODBC,
right?
Which go through the gateway, and so we have an ODBC application running on the hit node, talking to the master. You can get all of your tables from there, and then you can interface say, with Power BI or Tableau. It's a really cool technology to visualize your data
mm-hmm.
through a Spark.
Yeah, there's some cool demos out there that kind of show how that works.
Yes. Now, it's not as rich as what you could do with Zeppelin and Jupyter, right? Because, or even the Spark Summit, because there you can actually have Scala code execute. In ODBC, you just get the SQL-like language. So if you want to create a table, if you want to select star from a table, that's great. But if you want to really create an RDD or cache some data, those are commands that are only available to some of these richer apps.
Yeah, for the time being, definitely can see that being a good thing to know as you go and develop. One thing that I've found pretty cool in my kind of recent explorations within Spark is, I've done a lot of work on a typical MR cluster. And it can be really hard in your MapReduce code to actually count variables. So if you do something and it processes, and you create, say, for example, we were parsing XML objects, and you give each worker a set of XML objects to parse, and they're going through to those objects, and you want to count how many objects occur, and you want to be able to have a variable that goes across all of the nodes and looks at all the nodes and how many they've counted, was really hard in the MR confines. And Spark's made that really, really easy, like way easier. They have this variable called accumulator, which is going to allow you to update. You can use it as a counter that lives on the Spark Master, and then you are able to just increment it up and up and up, and then that variable is able to be read out at the end. So you can use that for incrementing and actually building upon, which I'm excited about and would have been a joy to have back 6 months ago, but we weren't quite ready with Spark. And that'll be pretty powerful if you have to ever count anything that happens across that distributed environment.
Yeah, so the cool thing about the driver is that once the driver is created and the RDD is created, if you do any actions on top of that RDD, the code is... You can say you can have a lambda function plugged into the action, and so that code gets distributed, serialized and distributed to the worker nodes. So all of them work on it, and the results that you said are distributed throughout the cluster, and you can do very powerful stuff with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, thanks, guys. This has been great. I appreciate taking the time and showing exactly kind of what the internals look like, and how you guys are developing and moving forward with the Spark project. I'm super excited to see when it goes GA and kind of see what we continue to add more and more features. Is there anything else that you guys want to talk about potentially and what's coming next? Or
no, we would just like, again, thank you, and maybe you can host and show our Twitter account so people can send questions.
Yep, that'll
questions.
Be right below us down here. There'll be a Twitter account. You should be able to see that.
So send us feedback, send us
comments, questions.
We'll be there to try and answer as much as we can. And thank you a lot for taking the time.
And these are the guys who actually own those services. So if you reach out to them and tell them your feedback, they'll be able to directly implement that into the cluster. So
yes.
Cool. Thanks a lot. I think in about a week or so, we're going to be releasing another video, and you should check that out. I think we're going to dive a little deeper into some of these components that we've talked up here. So we'll talk to you soon.